Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian for the week beginning the 22nd of March 2010. I'm Alex Kratosky, and in this program, we'll be rounding up the latest stories about technology from around the world and the web. There will be politics from both of the main UK political parties, underhanded cloak and dagger tactics by corporations who really should know better, and on a more positive note, an open source technology that brings the NGO community together via SMS. Joining me to debate the issues are Charles Arthur and Jemima Kish, who's been busy with new baby technology. Welcome back, Jemima.
Hello.
And what new baby technology have you discovered?
I looked at the Gruffalo website. It's brilliant. You can make sounds in the Sorry. This is going to happen a lot.
Charles, is there anything that you discovered when you started procreating? Any new technologies that caught your eye that you'd like to share with Jemima?
Gas and air, I understand, is pretty good.
The nozzle didn't work.
But everything's been going smoothly, and now you're back. How does it feel?
Oh, it's great. Really, really good technology that really helps in going back to work is childminding.
Ah.
Brilliant invention.
Excellent. Charles, can you give Jemima a quick roundup of what's happened in the past 9 months?
Okay, Google, Apple, YouTube, Digital Economy Bill, government, Gordon Brown Broadband, that's about it.
iPhone apps.
Well, it'll be a busy 30 minutes if we try and fit all of that in, but I think we can rise to the challenge. So stay tuned to Tech Weekly and see if we can.
Tech Weekly from Guardian.co.uk.
Well, here are the big stories from the world of technology this week. Last week, we told you about the Digital Economy Bill, Labour's fast-track legislation that was pushed through the UK Parliament, just as we described our concerns about it on the podcast. Well, this week, we've got more information from the Labour camp about their technological intentions for the next 4 to 5 years if they're re-elected in May.
Today, I want to announce £30 million to support the creation of a new institute, the Institute of Web Science, based here in Britain, working with government and British business to realise the social and economic benefit of advances in the web. It will assemble the best of world scientists and researchers. It will be headed by Sir Tim Berners-Lee, the British inventor of the World Wide Web, and the leading web science expert, Professor Nigel Shadbolt. This will help place the UK at the cutting edge of research on the semantic web and other emerging web and internet technologies.
This week, Gordon Brown unveiled plans in a speech titled Building Britain's Digital Future, which described new public policy initiatives, a new Web Science Institute, a fast broadband call to action, and all these things that they intend to roll out over the course of the next decade. Weighing in with the top advisors like Sir Tim Berners-Lee and LastMinute.com founder Martha Lane Fox, the plan primarily seeks to cut back on public spending by making government more wired for an increasingly wired populace. Charles, can you give us a little bit more detail on what happened in this speech?
Well, Gordon Brown announced that super fast broadband, as he called it, which is really fiber optic broadband up to 100 megabits per second and perhaps beyond, should be thought of as an essential service, rather like electricity, that everyone should be able to get it, that you wouldn't have sort of said to people, well, you live out in the rural sticks, so we're not going to give you electricity. There was the intention to create what he called a MyGov page, where each individual would be able to interact with central government and perhaps local government. It was a bit fuzzy here, though, of course, this is all predicated then on getting people online. There's 4 million people online who are probably, 4 million people who are not online, never use the internet, who are probably some of the heaviest users of central government services, things like, you know, job seekers, allowance, and so on. So that's where Martha Lane Fox comes in, partly because she's the UK's digital champion, and she would be in charge of a digital public services sort of office within the Cabinet Office. And there was also, because we're not finished yet, the confirmation that Ordnance Survey data will be made free from April the 1st.
And, of course, that's a real win for the Free Our Data campaign.
Big win for the Free Our Data. In fact, it's sort of like they drank the Free Our Data juice, actually, because there's all sorts of stuff like you can now download the locations of bus stops around the country. There's going to be what are called a doomsday book of all the non-personal data sets held by government, which will be implemented by autumn. So really the whole Free Our Data idea has just spread through government. And of course, you know, I can't quite claim all the credit because I think Tim Berners-Lee, who did something to do with the web, I don't know, has been the guy who's been pushing all this through within government and actually making it happen. Him and Nigel Shadbolt.
It's an extraordinary list of things that they seem to have announced. Is there anything that they've left out?
things I'd left out. Well, for the broadband question, there's a question of, well, actually, how would they do it? Do we start from the very rural areas and build inwards towards the centres? Or do we start at the sort of limit of where the broadband would sort of give up now and start building outwards? And that hasn't been answered. The question of when, you know, what's your target date? They've sort of suggested 2017, but I didn't get the impression from actually being there that Brown was really committing to 2017. And quite what proportion of the population, again, you know, is it 90%? Is it 100%? All a bit unclear.
Jemima, how different are these plans from when they started a decade ago?
God, these kind of bills are just designed to fail in a way, aren't they? I mean, there are obvious positive things in there, like supporting the creative industries, which nobody is going to say is a bad thing. But when it comes to the specifics of things that they're trying to do to stop piracy, for example, there's no way that this legislation can ever keep up with the technology. So this might affect services where you can leave and upload files online, like Dropbox and things. Because those providers, without knowing what people are uploading, aren't going to be able to have any control over what people are sharing. And the technology will always be one step ahead, no matter what they do, to try and attack piracy. So there's lots of hidden things within this that are just a nightmare.
What about with regards to how politically Labour is standing against the Conservatives when it comes to their technology manifesto? Because the Conservatives released their technology manifesto a fortnight ago, and one of the elements was this super fast broadband, which we discussed and we suggested was perhaps a little bit optimistic. As at Zantiak says on Twitter, he says, all the parties are promising super fast broadband. Talk is cheap, so let's see some action. They're only after votes. Bobby Johnson argues on the technology blog that Labour suggests that the broadband distribution would be based upon user need, not the market power or profitability, which he says is good news for the rural voters left in the lurch by the Tory plans, perhaps. But Charles, are there any unique selling points for either the Labour's manifesto or the Conservatives' manifesto? What are the unique elements in either party's discussions?
The ironic thing is that the Tory plan, which is very much we'll make the market will make it happen, and we're really not going to do the subsidising thing. They said that they wouldn't that they would throw out the £6 a year landline tax. The ironic thing is that the Labour subsidy would favour rural constituencies, which tend to be the Tory heartlands. The Labour approach would tend to favour mean that fast broadband would come much faster, much sooner to the urban constituencies, which tend to be the Labour ones. And it's clear that the two parties are vying with each other to sort of say, no, we can be much more geeky than you and much more personalised, and we can really get down to the bottom. The Tories are talking about a right to data access bill, which would be to non-personal data. So the two parties are really trying to make broadband and government data into election points, and I think they've sort of set their stakes in the ground there.
Well, it's been 3 years since U.S. movie distributor Viacom started the court proceedings against YouTube for copyright infringement, claiming that the Google-owned video sharing site was breaking the terms of use by refusing to take down clips of Viacom films in a timely manner. The court case, steadily brewing a nice froth since, blew a head of steam this week when it was uncovered that the YouTube founders had planted copyrighted material with the intent to profit, but that Viacom had been allegedly planting its own material on the site under pseudonyms from internet cafes and then demanding that YouTube take them down. Oh, what a tangled web, Jemima.
It's just astonishing. I couldn't believe it when I was reading. I mean, I don't know how Viacom claimed that they got hold of these emails, but emails between, the upper echelons of YouTube's management saying, oh, we really need to take this copyrighted stuff down. And then there was another email that I particularly enjoyed that said, we should take down the film and TV, but, the music and news and comedy, let's leave that up for another few years. But, so more questions raised than answered.
Certainly. Charles, do you think that what effect do you think these allegations are going to have on the court case and ultimately the decision?
Oh, it's really hard to know. It all depends on things like timing, intention, the extent to which things are breaches. If Viacom uploads stuff and knows that it's actually what it's doing is ostensibly wrong, then has Viacom violated its own copyright? I mean, you could argue that Viacom's got the right to upload its stuff anytime it likes.
They can sue themselves. Like, this is just so conflicting and so confusing. Yeah. Well, what is interesting is one of the allegations is that Google knew about this when they were buying YouTube. They knew that YouTube was uploading all of this infringing material. And YouTube co-founder Steve Chen said in an email that we just mentioned, he said that they were concentrating all of their efforts and building up their numbers as aggressively as they could through whatever tactics, however evil. That stands quite dramatically in contrast with Google's Do No Evil manifesto. So this makes me wonder what kind of evil Google actually are trying to not do. Is copyright an evil that they don't think should be in the world?
Their lawyers would also have done all the due diligence and probably come to the conclusion that they would be able to defend YouTube's use of copyright under the Digital Copyright Act.
Yeah. Or possibly the lawyers calculated that the amount they'd have to pay out in a lawsuit was less than the amount they could make in profit over the long term. I mean, yeah. I think that the question of what does Google think about copyright is an interesting one, because it's Google doesn't think that copyright is such an essential thing, partly because Google doesn't make content. Google uses content. Google has in effect made a big copy of the interwebs, which it holds in its servers. So if you're a strict believer in copyright, you wouldn't do that, because that's making a copy of the internet. You can't do that.
And of course, with their well-documented run-ins with the Writers Guilds, etc., about essentially copying all the books that are in the Boolean Library and various other organizations. It will be very, very interesting to see how this plays out. And it's nice to see that all of this mudslinging is happening. It makes it very tabloid, doesn't it?
Well, you sort of think these court cases have gone away because you don't hear for so long, and then something really juicy comes out.
This was juicy.
It was just waiting for you.
This was a big, juicy plum. Well, last week was the biggest technology event of the year. South by Southwest's annual New Media Love-In took place in Austin, Texas. And the festival, which has been credited with the success of web applications like Twitter in the past, is fiercely watched by industry observers. Jemima, you are an industry observer.
I had to be an observer this year because my ill baby son sabotaged my trip, but let's not go there. From my very diligent brother, who very obligingly went to all the parties on my behalf. Obviously, location was very hot this year. Gowalla and Foursquare were competing for everybody to check in on their sites. I think everyone just ended up using both of them. MG Siegler from TechCrunch was diligently trying to use all the location services he could. I think he checked into 11.
Imagine that he conflicted with himself at some point.
Well, he said it took 10 minutes to go anywhere because every time he got there, he had to check in. Anyway, so he was he did a great post saying that you need an aggregator so you can check into everything at once, which is a no-brainer. But there was no new Twitter this year. Twitter is still the new Twitter. My brother did go to a really interesting session with a developer called Jonathan Stark, who develops iPhone apps. And he's also developed JQ Touch, which allows you to develop iPhone apps, but they work in a browser. So you're effectively bypassing the iTunes App Store, which is very clever. He said there was a lovely moment in the audience when he showed a really beautiful graphic as part of this app, and the whole room of sort of 500 geeks went, "Oh," and then of course laughed at themselves because they realized how geeky they were.
Sounds like a South Park episode.
No, it's the bit in Toy Story where all the little green men are in the venue. Anyway, but still, the thing that is just what South Park is like for those who haven't been there. Despite all the geekery and the parties and all the hype, South By is really about meeting people. The strangest thing is you go there from London and you see more people from London than you'd ever see in one place at one time. So it's really just about sort of soaking up ideas and stuff. And if you haven't been there, you should give it a go once, really.
Well, just stick South By Southwest or SXSWI into Twitter search engine and be overwhelmed with the tweets.
Or not.
Yes. And catch up on absolutely everything that happened there, so you can do that. And you can catch up on all these stories and the rest of this week's headlines at guardian.co.uk/technology. A few weeks ago, Bobby Johnson spoke with a group of San Francisco technologists who were creating applications for newly connected territories in the developing world. Now, one of the things that came out of that discussion was how important mobile phones are for the distribution of the web in those regions. Recently, Kevin Anderson spoke with a developer who's using mobiles to help NGOs and nonprofits make the best use of these connected technologies, including in sectors like agriculture and healthcare. Frontline SMS's founder Ken Banks promotes text messaging as the way forward for bringing the best of the web, its vast library of information, into the lives and the routine practices of people in rural environments. Kevin began by asking him what Frontline SMS is.
Frontline SMS is a piece of software that you install onto, generally speaking, a laptop computer. You attach a mobile phone with a cable or a GSM modem, and using that you can do two-way text messaging to groups of people, to and from groups of people, anywhere there's a mobile phone signal. So if you're working in rural areas of developing countries and you're trying to disseminate health information or agricultural information, the system will work pretty much anywhere.
How did you come up with this idea?
In 2004, I was doing some work for a conservation organization in South Africa in an area called Bushbuck Ridge around Kruger National Park. The park's authorities were trying to re-engage the community in the conservation effort after about 85 years of not speaking to them. They'd noticed cell phones starting to appear in the hands of the communities, and they were starting to say, you know, how do we make use of the mobile phones they're owning to organize meetings, to give them information about the park, to try and get a sense of how they feel about things. So when I was looking for a tool that they could use to do group messaging with the communities, everything I found was web-based. So you had to go on the internet, you added your contacts, you typed a message, you hit send, you needed a credit card to pay for message credits, and none of that worked in Bushbuck Ridge back in 2004. And even today, I think you would struggle to get a reliable web connection. So a few months later, just back home in Cambridge, just suddenly sort of came up with the idea of just writing the software. And, you know, a cell phone attached to a laptop computer using local software with no need to have the internet at all. And just had a feeling that it might be something that was more widely useful to nonprofits outside of South Africa.
How has it been used?
The things they've done with it, monitored national elections in the Philippines, Malawi, Nigeria, running anti-human trafficking projects in places like Vietnam and now Haiti. Agricultural projects in El Salvador and Cambodia and Aceh after the tsunami. There's health-based networks in about 10 African countries now using it through Frontline SMS Medic, which is a spin-off organization which is now applying the software in health. So almost every facet of development, conservation as well, NGOs have found the use for it. So it's been quite exciting to see how they've just taken the tool and adapted it for their own particular use.
How has the development carried on? I mean, is it a crowdsource type project, or do you develop it and kind of move it along? I'm kind of interested in how these things go from the spark of your idea to now this quite widely used tool.
Well, when I launched it in 2005, I wrote the first version myself in 5 weeks on a kitchen table in Finland. I had no money at the time, so it was just a hunch it might be useful. In the last couple of years, we've open sourced it and rewritten it in Java, so it'll run on all platforms. There are developers around the world who are now being drawn to the project because they like what it does. It's very visible. It's clearly having great social change potential out there. So we're finding more and more people are gathering around the project and building add-ons, like Medic have built a patient record-keeping system for it, somebody building a microfinance module which will allow you to do mobile payments through the platform. We have people talking about applying it, adding an agricultural module and an educational module. So we're totally open for people to take the code and run with it. We have no sense of ownership over it.
It's one of these kind of crazy things. To do good, you still need to pay for it. I mean, have you attracted funding from outside sources now? Or?
Well, at the beginning, I raised a bit of money from a couple of ex-Vodafone directors that paid for a laptop and VB.net and a couple of phones and cables. At that time, I was subsidizing most of the work myself. So I took 5 weeks off work. I was doing consultancy at the time and just wrote the thing very, very quickly, built a website and threw it out there. Then went back to my day job. And I was just doing things in evenings and weekends, just trying to keep it going. We've been funded now, though, since the middle of 2007. MacArthur Foundation stepped in then after it was used in the Nigerian elections, which became a very big story. But right now we're being funded by the Rockefeller Foundation, the Hewlett Foundation, Open Society Institute, HEVOS, and we have a fifth donor announcing later on this month. So there's a lot of excitement around what we're doing because I think the model is very, very different. But we're now totally funded, so at least we can relax a little bit.
One of the things that's always interested me when I look at mobile phones in Africa is just the unintended uses that people have. You know, they've got a very simple tool, but then they adapt it in a myriad of ways. I mean, what are some of the ways that you've seen in Africa that just with simple SMS, that it's really changing the way that either they communicate or access services?
Yeah, I mean, I think some of the really interesting innovation that you're seeing now is coming from the developing world. So if we look at things like mobile banking, an M-Pesa in Kenya, which is based on the back of SMS. So however trivial SMS might be and how often we see people writing it off and saying, you know, SMS will be dead anytime soon, it keeps growing and growing. I can't pay for a cab outside this hotel with my cell phone. Right, well, if I was in Nairobi, I could. It's innovation kind of, it's happening in areas of scarcity. I've got ATMs, you know, we've got ATM machines, we've got banks, we've got internet banking. We're spoiled for choice. In many developing countries, you don't actually have that. So a lot of innovation is centering around that kind of activity. And also things like flashing and beeping, where people phone a number and they hang up as a way of giving a message without spending any money. That's pretty interesting as well as a behavior. And a number of anthropologists have done quite a lot of research on how that works. You know, two rings on a Friday means I'm okay. And, you know, that's a bit like we used to do years ago. You know, I'll phone your home phone once when I'm outside waiting for you, and you know I'm outside and ready to go. So you see a lot of that kind of stuff going on as well. But it's very much based on the innovation, very much based on people, the scarcity of money, the scarcity of resources, and just trying to find very, very interesting ways of using the technology to help people in their daily lives.
So, you know, obviously these are people just kind of DIY, coming up with solutions to problems or issues that they have. What effects do you see that mobile phones are actually having on these societies? Because obviously there are people who are adapting these tools, but how is it changing sort of developing societies, and if so, in what way?
If you speak to Nigerian traders, or you go around rural Kenya or Uganda, and you speak to people who have just made their first ever telephone call on a mobile, or just had their first internet experience on a mobile, and you see the fact there's no landlines, there's no other telecommunications infrastructure in sight, and if there is, it's broken and very badly maintained. And then you ask them what the impact is and how much they value it, and it is immense. Nigerian traders will fight you to the death for their cell phones, because many will argue that is their livelihood, and it allows them to run their businesses in a much more efficient way than they ever thought possible. If you look in places like South Africa, where, you know, at 8 o'clock in the morning, you might have all the painters and decorators standing on a street corner waiting for business. People will drive past, pick one up, and they'll go off the day and do work. When they're not on that corner, they can't get future business. But now they can stick their mobile phone number on a piece of wood. They can nail it somewhere and say, if you want a painter and decorator, call me. And they can now get business while they're on other jobs. Mm. And it's really increasing economic opportunity in so many ways. And, of course, the movement of people from rural areas to urban areas to find work and employment. They might have previously struggled to keep in touch with their family or to see how their wife and children were doing. Mobile phones now allow them to call home more often. And now, of course, we're seeing more and more mobile payments being sent directly back to people through their mobile phones as well. Health information is being delivered, agricultural information. People can report human rights abuses. I mean, it really is revolutionary, I guess, although that word is often overused.
That was Kevin Anderson with Ken Banks from Frontline SMS. And you can find out more about Frontline SMS at frontlinesms.com. That's it for this week. Many thanks to our guest, Ken Banks from Frontline SMS, and to our pod regulars, Jemima, welcome back, and Charles. Thanks, as always, to our intrepid and inherently patient producer, Scott, in the booth. Now, tonight, if you're listening to this on the 23rd of March, that's Tuesday, we're hosting a live recording of this podcast at the Science Museum in London, part of the week-long DigiFest series of technology and digital media events, which, you know, I have to be open. I'm the person who curated it. So we'll be speaking about data censorship and data privacy with two special guests, Austin Heap of the Censorship Research Center and Christina Zaba from No2ID. If you've got any questions, ping them to us by 5 p.m. on Tuesday evening on Twitter. That's GuardianTW. If you can't make it to the live Tech Weekly recording, the rest of DigiFest's events might tickle your fancy. Wednesday night is a debate about the web as the ultimate propaganda machine. How is it being used by governments and special interest groups to recruit and galvanize? Is it any different from how other media has been used in the past? Thursday night is a debate about the things that games really teach us, from capitalism to individualism. And Friday sees the return of the Tech Weekly podcast team and other special guests at a night of Pechacucha 2020, what technology you can't and shouldn't live without. Join me, Jemima, Charles, and tech luminaries from games to web to find out more. Now, all the events are free, so go sign up at danacenter.org.uk. But check out the Live Tech Weekly next Tuesday. And if you'd like to get in touch to tell us what you think, head to guardian.co.uk/techweekly, to our Twitter feed, GuardianTW, where we'll post up information and we'll look for feedback about the topics that we'll be covering every week. Thanks very much for listening. I'm Alex Kratosky.